Dog will hunt.
Welcome back to episode 2 of Chopping It Up. This week we're comparing and contrasting Tobe Hooper's groundbreaking 1974 Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Hooper's sequel nearly a decade later, the 1986 film The Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. Once again, I'm your host, Jesse Goodman, and here are my co-hosts, Joel Reeves and Michael Sled. Also wanted to give a big shout out to our producer, Jay, for keeping the ship together and making us sound slightly less dumb than we actually are. So with that said, let's get to it. All right, first impressions and thoughts. Joel, I'm going to go ahead and let you lead off on this.
Sure. So the 74 version is, one, it's pretty short. It's thin on plot, but it is atmospherically a spectacular film. It is really creepy, and listening to people do interviews talking about the film at the time, people remember much more gore and blood than's actually in it, which is all a credit to Hooper doing his thing.
Well, this wasn't, just to be clear, this is not the first time you've seen it, right? This is
no. I've seen it probably 4 times all told.
Okay, the last time was many years ago. Yeah,
it was like 20 years ago. So it's been it's been a long time, and it still has the same effect.
Okay.
Right. And two is more of like a dark comedy. It's also a lot of fun. I think it's not quite as good as one, but I know I'm like, that's controversial in this group. But I had a great time watching both.
Michael, what'd you think?
I mean, one is a classic. So one is up there within easily my top 5 of horror movies all the time, as far as just the intensity and how much feelings it evokes, how uncomfortable it makes you, particularly in the context of when it was made, how early it was in the genre and what it does. Just a lot of the stuff that Joel mentioned, I mean, the cinematography is fantastic. Just the feelings coming as a Texas person, it's very recognizable to me. I grew up in Central Texas, so when I see it, a lot of the vibes that are there in it, the creepiness, the kind of the desolation, the abandonment of all these things around that certain time, they very much hit home for me. So like that's part of it, having watched it as a kid. And also growing up as a kid, I think I was already in my 20s by the time I actually realized when it was around when the internet became around that I realized it wasn't actually based on true events.
It was harder to look those things up back in the day.
Yeah.
So like, I remember someone's older brother being like, no, that's bullshit. But no one knew that until a long time into it. And so that part of it was a really big impact. Second movie, it's just so different. It's almost like comparing apples and oranges. I mean, it's also there's a lot of Texas stuff in there that if
You'd seen the sequel already. Yeah. You'd seen the
movie. Okay. Yeah, no, I remember seeing it when I was young and being really weirded out by it, mostly because it is so weird, intentionally so.
Yeah.
So, and it's just like it is much more, the comedic effect on it is really extreme. And my understanding is, I guess there was some intention of that with the first movie, but it was maybe not understood, and that was part of the intention of creating the second one.
Yeah, awesome. All right, well, I'd seen both of them, like Joel and like you, Michael. It had been many, many years since I'd seen the original. I had seen the sequel in bits and pieces, over the years. I was surprised at how spare and like art housey the original was. Like Joel said, it was so thin in terms of plot. I guess I remembered more happening plot-wise in the original. I still loved it. I loved that it was like moody and atmospheric and that whole vibe, haunting and foreboding. The sequel, full disclosure, I'm like a mark for the sequel. I love it. I absolutely love it. I actually was very much how I remembered it. Hyperbolic, satirical, and, you know, gore galore. I do realize in retrospect that I missed a lot of the subtext that Hooper had in there, but we can obviously circle back to that and break that down in depth later on. But I enjoyed them both. It was difficult viewing for the first one. It was like I was caught between being like, I say scared, but you know, it builds that in you, that tension in you. But also I was like, God damn, we're 40 minutes in before you see, and Joel and I talked about this, you know, we were the whole week, we were biting our lips, trying not to talk too much about it, but it was like, we're 40 minutes in before you see a chainsaw in the original. Yep. And
well, I think only one person is actually killed by a chainsaw.
That's right.
That's right. Like everyone else has a sledgehammer. Yeah, it's crazy.
Only Franklin. Only Franklin. Well,
the chick gets put on a hook. So I guess it depends on how you want to count she got killed. But
yeah. And the hitchhiker gets hit by a truck. But you're right. Only one person gets hit. And in my mind, I was like, 40 people get killed by a chainsaw, yeah. Right?
But that's funny because, and it goes back to when it came out and what you guys were talking about. This is obviously pre-advent of the internet, and it was like word of mouth, man. This was, and not to ruin what we'll likely get to later in the pod, but this was like, in a lot of ways, the precursor to like Blair Witch and like muddling the lines between reality and fiction when you could get away with that. People could fact check you in real time. And that whole intro narration for the original, which Joel loves to give the fact on, who was doing the narration for the original, Joel?
So this is a funny one. John Larroquette. So the guy from Night Court.
Dan
from, yes.
Does the narration. He was friends with Hooper, and the rumor, it's just a rumor, was that he got paid in a case of beer and a half an ounce of pot back in the day for doing the narration.
That's really
funny. I wonder what the brand of beer was, if it was Lone Star or Shiner.
It's got to be Shiner. Yeah, that's right. Gotta be
I would
Shiner.
Assume it's Shiner.
Shiner's all over the sequel, right?
All over the sequel. It's everywhere.
All right, so now let's go ahead and dig into Joel's favorite part of the pod, which, of course, is Joel's movies statistics. So, Joel, what'd you dig up for us in terms of, you know, directors, significant actors, any stories about the numbers, gross, domestic, international, all that stuff?
All right, so I'll run through the first one. Obviously, we already said director, Toby Hooper. Writer was Hooper and Kim Hinkle. Hinkle ends up doing another movie. They split on bad terms for a little while, and they reunite later on. But they did a movie. Almost the whole cast comes back together at some point to see or to be in a movie called Butcher Boys, which is apparently terrible. Somewhere in the like early 80s. So cinematography, which we've already mentioned, was Daniel Pearl. So Daniel Pearl went into mostly like music videos after this. And in fact, Hooper later on in between the two movies, because there's 12 years there, shot and produced a Billy Idol music video, like the Dancing With Myself music video. That was Hooper. Okay. And Pearl worked with him on that. So runtime for the movie is a lean hour and 23 minutes, at least the version I watched, but they're all probably right around there. The budget was about $60,000, although there's a little bit of a debate back with the numbers just because it's so long ago, but somewhere around there. And it made $31 million. So it was a huge hit. All of that's domestic. Like, pretty much nothing happened internationally from its release.
Okay.
It's got big scores and very, very well received critically. It's like a 7.4 on IMDb, so the audience really enjoys it. But the Metascore is like 90, which is very high. So it's very, very well thought of now. And Rotten Tomato was at 89%. So, like I said, the big reveal to me was the Larroquette thing. That blew my mind when I was reading about this. But a lot of the actors don't show up in Texas Chainsaw 2. So Gunnar Hansen, who plays Leatherface, doesn't reprise his role. It's Bill Johnson in the second one. There was a contract dispute, and they decided to replace Hansen. I think it was Canon itself, the production company, that swapped him out. So Jim Sydow is the credited as the old man in the first one, but he gets a name in the second one, right? Mm-hmm. And then Marley Burns is Sally, who's arguably one of the first one or two, depending on how you count it, final girls ever on screen.
Right? That's what they call them?
Really, final girls, scream queens, all of that. So then moving on to two, that comes out 12 years later, like I said, in 1986. Cooper came back for that. Like Michael was saying, he decided to very consciously go in a different direction. I think he just didn't want to make like a continuation of the same film. So he did it. It's much darker. It's much gorier or darker comedy. It's much gorier than before. The cinematographer there was Richard Corris. Special effects is our man, Tom Savini. He's over number two. So despite everything Jesse was saying, the scores aren't as good for this one, for number two.
Bunch of bullshit.
What do they know? What's that?
I said it's a bunch of bullshit. That's all.
That's right.
It's all fake news.
But the audience score is still pretty high. It's 5.6. The Metascore is a lot lower. It's 42. But the Rotten Tomato for this one is higher than any of the modern takes on Texas Chainsaw.
So, as it should be.
And then, of course, the cast, you have Dennis Hopper showing up for this, which as Lefty, which is crazy. From my research, it looks like one of the writers, so the original writer, obviously, is Toby Hooper, and a man named L.M. Kit Harris, I think. I have it written down, but it's all smudged. But he worked on a independent film with Hopper, and I think that's how he got pulled into the movie.
Kit Carson.
Thanks,
L.M. Kit Carson. Yeah.
So Carolyn Williams is strapped. All right. So, and Bill Moseley shows up as Chop Top. He's famous for all the Rob Zombie movies. He's spectacular in this role. So two cameos I think you guys will appreciate. Toby Hooper shows up himself in the movie briefly.
Oh, wow.
He's in the hallway when Stretch is coming to see Dennis Hopper in his little hotel room. He walks by and throws something at someone.
Oh my God. That's it. Yeah. Exactly what you're talking about. Okay.
And then there, so Jesse will know who this is, but Kinky Friedman is the, sports anchor.
I went to high school with Kinky Friedman's nephew.
No That's way. Crazy. Kinky Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys. Yep.
A big local musician. He hit on the national scene, but...
Wait, so who was he, Joel? Where does he pop up?
He's a sports anchor. I don't know exactly. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I think it's towards the end when they're doing the chili cook-off and they're doing all of that back and forth.
See, I thought I was going to have the most obscure musical or musician reference for this. But because the movie was in part inspired by Loudon Wainwright III, his song called Dead Skunk. And he was a folk singer-songwriter in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, which was super duper obscure. Because you know that the original opens with the dead armadillo, right, in the highway, which is it's like a Native American I see. I had like a Native American symbol of protection.
Have either of y'all seen a dead armadillo in real life?
No.
No.
Just curious.
I have. It's also the
thing. I've seen it. Or at least, hopefully it's not in a bad one because I've seen a lot of them.
It's supposed to be a symbol of protection in many Native American cultures. And it was the small mammal, the state small animal of Texas. So it's basically representing the death also of the decline of Texas.
You know, from the zombie perspective, they carry leprosy.
Really? What?
Yeah.
All right. Don't cuddle with the armadillo.
Don't cuddle with the armadillo. Oh, go ahead, Joel.
No. I forgot one thing. I wanted to say on the budget, it was $4.7 million, and the movie grossed about $8 million. So it doubled its money, which from a movie perspective needs to be closer to like 2.5 to 3 times because marketing is such a big chunk of what they do. That's just the production budget. So it kind of lost money on the thing. But it did well enough to continue the series. So, sorry. Go ahead, Jess.
My other actor, who I really loved him. My favorite character in either movie was LG McPeter. The stretches in part two stretches co-host or board man at the radio station. He's played by Lou Perryman. Lou Byron Perryman. I share the same middle name with LG.
You told me about this. Oh my God.
Now, the crazy thing about this dude is, like, he was just a character actor. He was actually in the film crew for Hooper on the original, and they decided to bring him on and give him a role in the sequel. So I was, like, reading up on him just because he's like a goofy cowboy. Like, I just liked his character, right? He was fucking murdered by a crazed axe murderer who broke into his house and hacked him to death in real life.
You had that too?
Yeah.
when Jesse told me that, I was like, get the fuck out of here. Are you kidding? Yeah.
It's wild. It's wild shit. But that was all I had. Sled, what did you have? Did you have anything for actors and anything?
No, you fucked it up now because I was going to mention I will say that he always reminded me, Jesse and I are both big wrestling fans. I always thought of him as a honky tonk man lookalike. For some reason, he always reminded me of a honky tonk.
How about this? Joel said this to me, and this actually is just as uncanny. If you listen to Drayton Sawyer, right, the chef, if you listen to him cackle, sled, just like Dave Chappelle's laugh.
He does the Dave Chappelle like scream laugh, like right, like it's that. Yeah. It is. You could put the two next to each other. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't want to. Yeah.
You have to watch. Speaking of putting things next to each other, that's a good segue to this. So I showed the guys this picture, and Jay's going to see if he can splice it into the YouTube feed. But it's
for those of you.
If you take the Breakfast Club poster and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 poster, it is clearly a parody of the Breakfast Club. The poster.
Question for you here.
Yeah.
Who is the guy on the bottom right?
Oh, you know this one, Jess. You were telling me.
The guy on the bottom right.
The camo guy. Who is that supposed to be?
That's Leather. Oh, that's not Leatherface. Oh, that's the hitchhiker, aka Nubbins, in the original.
Oh, his brother is
Chop Top's twin brother.
Right? Like, yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Which you only really see Nubbins at the very end when they're like he's under the table and stuff.
Yeah, he pulls him down.
There's a period where they're like carrying him around, and
him on the truck in the first scene? Is that him?
You think that might be him? I think you might be right. Okay. Yeah,
I can never figure that out.
I mean, Chop Top does basically carry him around a lot, so he's very very close with his brother. I do have notes on that. It is absolutely a representation of the dysfunctional family. But let's. We'll circle back to that. Let's go ahead and Joel. Unless you had anything else, let's go ahead and
That was my last gem, that poster. I thought that was great.
All right, so getting into the cultural slash cinematic importance for both of these films. I'm going to go ahead and lead off, if you guys don't mind, for this one.
Go for it.
You know, the original obviously became the cult classic that it is now, terrified viewers at the time. I read an article that during the original screenings, after the movie ended, the original, with Leatherface doing his chainsaw dance in the middle of the road, audiences were stunned into silence. There was no clapping, there was no laughing, there was no cheering, there was nothing. It was just silence. And the years after, obviously, it's become one of the most famous horror movies of all time, and deservedly so. Hooper sort of brings that, as far as significance, he brings that documentary style, the gritty filmmaking to prominence. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, it's sort of a DIY shoestring budget film, blends reality with fiction. And years later, we get Blair Witch and a bunch of others that sort of try to emulate it and create that backstory. There's actually a lot less gore than I recalled, like you mentioned, Joel. And I think Hooper just sort of hints at it and alludes to it, but he doesn't go over the top. And then in the sequel, he intentionally goes the opposite way with the help of Tom Savini on practical effects. He just goes fucking bonkers. I mean, there's people getting skinned alive. There's a head chainsawed in half within the first 9 minutes, going 100 miles an hour in a car. But I would submit that the sequel actually is a cult classic in its own right. It just had more of a slow burn over the years. It extended the mythology. It managed to indict a whole generation in a way that the original didn't. And there was a quote that I thought that popped into my head apropos of the first one, and it's from Hunter S. Thompson from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It says, history is hard to know because of all the hired bullshit, but even without being sure of history, it seems entirely reasonable to think that every now and then the energy of a whole generation comes to a head in a long, fine flash for reasons that nobody really understands at the time, and which never explain in retrospect what actually happened. There was madness in any direction at any hour, if not across the bay, then up the Golden Gate or down the 101 to Los Altos or Los Honda. You could strike sparks anywhere. There was a fantastic universal sense that whatever we were doing was right and that we were winning. And that, I think, was the handle, that inevitable sense of victory over the forces of old and evil. Not in any mean or military sense. We didn't need that. Our energy would simply prevail. There was no point in fighting on our side or theirs. We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave. So now, less than 5 years later, you could go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west. And with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark. That place where the wave finally broke and rolled back. To me, this is about the death of the new American West, the frontier, and that entire counterculture movement. This is why all the hippies are represented that way. They're silly. They have no real ideology. Everything is Mercury and Retrograde, which, by the way, was an alt title, one of the suggested alt titles.
Yep.
It's just gobbledygook that she's reading from.
What was an alt title?
Mercury and Retrograde, which they're reading that astrology book periodically.
Gotcha.
And so for me, you know, the failure of that whole movement, Hunter S. Thompson gets it, you know, the wave breaks, you can see the high water mark. It's all downhill from there. That was my first take.
Yeah, so I more or less agree with everything you just said. Like, so Hooper's, like you said, he was a documentarian. That's where he cut his teeth out of film school, in local documentaries. But his first feature-length movie was a movie called Eggshells, which I haven't had a chance to watch yet. But it's apparently all, like, hippie, psychedelic, and the virtues of that culture. And in a lot of ways, Chainsaw, he says, is a counter to that, because they made nothing, meaning the entire cast, they made nothing on Eggshells. Because it was, even though people liked it, right? Like, they just, it's not commercially viable. So They literally were like, we need to make a horror movie, because Last House on the Left had just made gobs of money in 1972. So if you think about when this hits in history, the movie was probably being made in 1973. It's released in 74. So you're like a year and a half away from the United States pulling out of Vietnam, right?
Watergate,
like the real death of the hippie movement is going on right there.
Yep.
In addition to that, you have the dying of the labor unions. And it's the, industrialization
basin
in this country, right? And so you start getting things hollowed out where the working class starts to lose its jobs and lots of small towns in America start to dry up. And I think those are two of the major themes that he's really trying to drive home. And I honestly don't know how he does it so well with such a thin plot. It really resonates, and he just, it's magic. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah.
So that's my initial stuff.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, the industrialization or deindustrialization theme is even mentioned in Texas Chainsaw 2, which is like a little lighter on that social commentary, right? Like, I think it's more focused around like the rise of the yuppies and disdain for them, right? Both films do talk about and address that this family of killers has been displaced by new processes and technologies that have hit the meatpacking industry.
Right.
So I find that interesting.
It's the sledgehammer in the van when they get in. Nubbins, the hitchhiker, gets in, and no, the sledgehammer is not how you do it. It's it's the gun. That's killing us. We can't. No, you got to do it the sledgehammer way. So that way of life is being phased out. That's the industrialization.
I think there's a lot of it. There's so much cinematography that goes into it that you see all of those things happening. I mean, for me, watching it, I'm a plant guy, so when I watch the plants and the stuff that I see that's going on, like when I say plants, I mean literally plants. Like when I watch the upgrowth around the buildings, I see like there's a lot of shots that are looking off from the highway, and I don't know if this is intentional or if it's just something that they captured well. But like the idea, like Johnson grass. So Johnson grass is a common thing you see along all the highways in Texas. Mm-hmm. It's not made grass, but it's something that was planted as fodder for cows all over the state. And so you see that in a lot of shots where it's along the sides of the road. And it actually turns out it's not great for cows. Like they can't eat a lot of it. They get bloat and they die from it. Or there's a lot of, like when they show the family homestead, it's all grown up with plants and it's grown up with China berries, which are another non-native plant that are planted around that area that are all growing up around the building. And it's just like, it's kind of things, if you look at it closely, and I don't know that if they even in 74 or 73 that they even understood that, but they knew what they were looking at, I guess, when I would say when you're looking at it.
These are invasive species of plants?
Yeah, they're not native plant. Like China berry's been in the U.S. for a long time. I think Benjamin Franklin actually is the first guy who brought China berries actually to the U.S. But they're not native plants, and they tend to grow up in areas, disturbed areas. So invasive plants do best in areas that are disturbed by industry. So if you go down and cut down native forests, you get these certain types of plants. They grow up and like they're invasive, not because they're invasive, but because they have natural characteristics that make them really good at like intruding into these disturbed areas, right? Like they reproduce fast, they handle certain conditions well. And so I think it's a circumstance that you notice all these things and they make you, I don't know if they make you feel whatever, but the whole movie is made around making you feel uncomfortable. The whole movie's hot. It's sweaty as shit. Everyone looks like fucking miserable, right? Like everyone
really are.
My God. Like it's just like, and so like, I think like that goes into part of it as far as like, it's just, it's, it's incredible. And two gets that a little bit different. And two is actually the really big difference in two. And one of the things I wrote down is that two is filmed up in Northeast Texas, where it's right. it's wetter and cooler. It's a much greener film. Like if you watch the outsides of it, it's like everything's relatively green, even when they're driving through. It doesn't look so gross.
Less uncomfortable. Right.
Yeah, the grossness is with the gore and like the actual right. stuff that's going on, rather than just the setting and the ambiance, which is like all what the one is about.
Well, the original actually was in excess of 110 degrees on the set. They were regularly passing out and throwing up. The cast was, and yep. I did want to say though, I mean, it's a huge stretch, Sled, but you brought up the species, and I wanted of plants, and I wanted to make sure that they were invasive. You said non-native. Like, if there was any, who knows if Hooper or Henkel had any idea what they were. Henkel's from, well, he's born in Virginia, but he is grew up in several small towns in South Texas, so he was not unfamiliar with Texas. But if it's an invasive species and he was aware of that as a representation for something, you know, the invasiveness of the hippies coming into the place where they shouldn't be. But more than that, yeah, I think the Texas on the verge of Texas and America by proxy in this time, on the verge of institutional collapse. In the initial part of the first one, they're talking about there's a cholera outbreak. There's grave yeah. robbers. There's oil storage units and refineries are exploding and burning out of control. There's a rash of suicides and imitation yep. copycat suicides. This is yeah. this is the failure of the new American West and the frontier. Child torture. It's yeah. So yeah. so like all of this is about the decay of Texas yeah. and of this way yeah. of life.
And some of the early. Have y'all ever been in a cattle town? There's one of the parts where they're driving in the van in the very early, like they're driving through a town and they're talking, and it's when they, after they picked up the hitchhiker, maybe, or maybe it's slight before, but they're talking about like, oh, what's that smell? Like if you've mm-hmm. driven through an actual cattle town, like it's like, I mean, it's awful. I mean, I remember like the last time I drove into Texas to actually, coming through that part of the country, was coming back, and I drove through North Texas, and it's like, it's really incredible. Like you'll drive in and it's like, oh, there's a cattle yard. I remember driving in, it was close to night and there were lights like lighting up the horizon, and all you could see was dust. And it's the closer and closer you got to dust, the worse it smelled. And it was all just like, once you got into the actual town, I think it was either Dumas or Dalhart, Texas, which is like far north. North, right. far northwest of where it was filmed, but it's like, it was the cattle yard, and it's like, it smells like death. Like the whole city just smells like animal, like, and they have those scenes where they have the cattle just like huffing out of their faces, and they're dropping yeah. snot and stuff, and it's just like, the whole thing is meant to make you uncomfortable, and it's like, if yeah. you've actually been there and seen it, like, it's very, like, I don't know. It's like it's visceral, like as far as how it triggers yeah. you. Like holy shit! Yeah. Like,
well, yes,
that's one of the things that I think is so effective with one. So we all know, but I'll say it for the listeners. Some of the influence for this movie was a serial killer in Minnesota. Is that right, Michael?
Ed Gein, Wisconsin.
Yeah, Ed Gein. Is it Minnesota? Is that right?
Wisconsin.
I think it's in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, okay. And he would take the skeletons of his victims or people from graves and make furniture and things like that out of it. And it's all over this movie, right? Obviously, it's influenced Psycho and Hannibal Lecter and all of those characters, but
and in a Warren Zevon Excitable Boy.
Really?
I didn't know that. About
that's a fantastic
shit.
Song.
He's talking about like do raping and killing her karaoke. And building something out of yeah. her bones. Yeah, that's all.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So where I was going with that is that like that, you know, all of that as a backdrop to like the thing you said, Michael, where it's like it smells like death. It's just the exterior of the town is such a great precursor to this when you see the interior of their den, right? For lack of a better term. I mean, you go in and there's body parts and, you know, bones everywhere, right? Like, it's just, it's so well done.
I was going to say it's, I just have in my notes, like, bleak, dark, gothic. It's the moribund American way of life, the nuclear family gone wry. Like, I without much segue, but I really want to talk about, because we had the hitchhiker in the van. He goes nuts. He's cutting himself. He takes Franklin's knife and he's cutting himself. But Sled, you were talking about the stench of slaughterhouses in these cattle towns. I had like this weird thought. Are Franklin and the hitchhiker like mirrors of, are they blood brothers? They're blood brothers. He gives it to him. It's his knife. And he's like, do you think his blood's on this knife? First of all, I wanted to kill Franklin myself, but we'll come back to that later.
I want to jump. Like, I don't know where we are on staging, but like, the hitchhiker is actually the scariest guy in even in the first movie.
Yeah, and they're so close together.
Well, even his twin Chop Top in the second movie. If we're not restricting our conversation to both, he's also the scariest guy in the second movie.
Yeah,
and they're both like. If you've had enough time, or I don't know if you've experienced people who have like schizophrenia and are a little off, they're both, the performances of both those guys are fucking amazing. Honestly.
Yeah.
Like, they're just like, they're easily, to me, the scariest guys in both. Like that scene in the van where he's making them so uncomfortable. There's nothing even going on at the beginning, right? Like they're just like, they pick the guy up, they're partying, they're driving around. Yeah. But he makes it so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, through his performance and like what he's doing, you're just like, fuck this, like, it's a tremendous performance. Like, I can't, like, not bend that enough. Like,
I had the same thought, Jesse and Michael. One, Bill Moseley, especially like Chop Top in the second one, I find him absurdly disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember from a kid when he met her in the studio, when he's waiting for her that first time she meets him, and I was like, this guy's creepy as fuck. Like, and I guess he sold that to them, right? Like, he did, like...
Do you know where he got the job? So, I was telling Jesse this earlier. So, he, after Texas Chainsaw 1, he was a fan. And he somehow met, I don't know how, it didn't say in the article, somehow met Toby Hooper and showed him a short film he had done as a parody, which was called The Texas Chainsaw Manicure. And I really want to see this thing. I don't know if you can find it, whatever, but I really want to see it. And Toby Hooper loved it. He loved it and was like, I will remember you if you ever do a sequel. And sure enough, he did. And I mean, and Moseley has had a career of being that creepy-ass guy with all the zombie movie, like Rob Zombie movies, that is. And obviously Texas Chainsaw 2, so it's great.
I want to drive the point home, and then we can move on. But Franklin and the hitchhiker, I literally think are duels of each other. Okay, because they so he takes his knife, he cuts himself with the knife, right? It's a ritual sacrifice of some sort. He hands him back the knife, and then later Franklin talks about, man, could you imagine if I could do that? Could you just cut yourself? And he's, I think that's his blood on there. Is that his blood? And he was so enamored. Everyone else was terrified. Franklin wasn't terrified when the hitchhiker was in the van. He was enamored with it. Wait. Oh, your uncle. So he says, the hitchhiker says, my uncle and my grandfather are both in the business. Moments before he gets in there, Franklin says his uncle and his grandfather are in the business. Hold on. And Franklin, of course, because he's a fucking loser, when they actually get to the house and he rolls around, everyone's having fun upstairs in the old house, messing around, maybe having sex or doing whatever. And he's downstairs wheeling around in his wheelchair, and he's just like, no, I had too much fun. And he starts blowing raspberries. Hold on. Wait, when they kick the hitchhiker out, right? And he's kicking the van and wiping his blood. He's blowing raspberry. Dude, they're also the respective outcasts in their families, right? Yeah, go ahead, Sled.
I think you're right.
No, that's exactly where I was going to go. They're both like outcasts in their families. Like, everyone fucking hates Franklin. And then also, what you realize, like, once they get the girl back to the house, like, the hitchhiker, he shows up late, right? Like, they're already getting down working their magic when he comes stumbling up the fucking field with like a possum that he's shaking in his hand, and his older brother's like yelling at him. Well, we don't even know the relationship in the first one. We learn that more as we get into the second one. But yeah, he's like, and then when he get up there, it's like he's a piece of shit. Like they don't like him. He's annoying. Mm-hmm. He's like the outcast. And yeah, they definitely
Imagine being the outcast in a family where, so Chop Top and Hitchhiker, Nubbins is his name, they're brothers. Leatherface is a brother.
Twin brothers.
What's that?
Supposed to be twins, right?
They're twin brothers.
I think they're twins, yeah.
They're twins. Leatherface is their other brother. Drayton Sawyer, the chef, is their uncle, right? Their grandfather,
I think. I think is he supposed to be their uncle or their big brother?
He's their big brother.
Because he says that right,
No, you're right. No, but Sled, that's where I'm going with it. He is the older brother, but the grandfather's upstairs, right? He's barely alive. The grandmother is dead. The grandmother was their sister. Their mother is their sister.
Well, that's so disturbing.
That's their family lineage, which gets fleshed out more in the other versions in the family.
So I had a similar thought about Franklin and the Hitchhiker, just that Franklin is clearly the one who is the least uncomfortable with him, right? For whatever reason. And he is also the only non-hippie there. Right. Mm-hmm. And so at some level, I think they're trying to be like, he is whatever this post hippie person is that Franklin is more similar to this, you know, murderer. Right. And again, it's one of those things where they don't say any of this, right? Like none of this is explicit. It's all implied, like you pick it up as it goes along. But every, you know, all three of us came to the same basic conclusion, right? I don't know how you do that, but.
Yeah. I did want to talk about also the theme of, in the first one, it's the death of the counterculture movement, industrialization, the decaying part of, you know, the American West. And then in the sequel, it's this indictment of like 80s era Reaganism, right? Hmm. And instead now Hooper turns his lens on, I guess, what was it? The roaring 20s and the roaring 80s. I mean, sometimes
part of it, you have to start off with like, how does the second one start? Right? Like it starts with like Buzz and fucking what's his name? Like
Rick
they're
the
driving
prick.
Their
Rick
car.
The prick.
And the guy's got like big the titties, glasses yes. on. And they force, like they pick the fight, right? Like they pick,
yeah, they
the,
pick
fight.
The fight with
they
the farmer.
Force Leatherface and his brother off the road.
Yeah.
They're definitely like they're somewhere they're going with like that's a message. Like that was not a coincidence to start the movie off from that transpoint, right?
I did want to say though, as just before we keep getting into that, that the license plate for Rick the Prick and Buzz, which says FAH Q,
fuck you, right?
Is hold on, this is 1986. Later, years later, when Dazed and Confused, Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused comes out, Ed O'Bannon, who's played by Ben Affleck, and they have those paddles they're beating the freshmen up with, right? They're smacking them with the paddles. His is fuck you, which I don't know if it's an ode to Hooper or just an absolutely bizarre coincidence, but I thought I'd point that out.
Dazed and
definitely
Confused is also set in Texas. Keep that in mind.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
That is true, yeah. I didn't even think of that.
So this is you start moving into lefty, Bodie, lefty and right, as an, I have him in the era of Reaganism and the decade of decadence, I have him as an avatar of neoconservatism, moral majority type. And then it's also, the whole film is populated with the Buzzes and the Rick the Pricks of the world. These privileged, they have a car phone in 86, the convertible, they're banging down Shiners, they're going to go. It's 80s Reaganism, middle management, polo wearing, capitalism, and cowboy cosplayers is what I have. It's almost like a David Roth.
Did you notice that Drayton, chili guy, he has the phone, but he has the fucking beatbox in his car for a radio. Like, he has the car, like, and a car phone at that point in time was like a did he steal
it's
that?
Pretty unusual.
That's the question. Like, he had the car phone in his car, but then he had like a fucking beatbox in his car for the actual audio.
But Drayton sold out, and in the
sequel, like, don't call me on this phone, because I remember that being as a kid. I had an aunt that had a fucking car phone in her room.
He's sold out now. He's that same middle management boat owning piece of shit.
He tries to buy his way out of Lefty's revenge. Remember, he actually pulls out a lot of cash. We're all over the place, but. Like, it is one of those things where I think you're right, where it's he sold out. I do want to talk about the music selections in Chainsaw 2, because there's some great songs on the soundtrack.
All right, let's hold off on that, but let's stick with this theme. And I did want to talk do you guys want to talk about – I wanted to talk about – we got into it the last episode, Sled, before you were on. Just the idea of where religion and God fits in. I'll kick that off and see what you guys think. I had the first one, the original, as a godless sort of secular horror. It's not there. It's the absence of God. And that's why they're reading this mysticism, this Mercury and retrograde bullshit. And I think Sally at some point says, you know, everything means something, really, which is the same as saying nothing means anything, right? It's tantamount to that. And then the sequel, of course, is the absolute opposite. I mean, it's not secular horror. Lefty is obsessed with God and divinity and absolution and all of that. And he's constantly quoting him. He's talking about, you know, God, I ain't got no fear left. Give me the strength.
He joins the battle singing Bringing in the Sheep, right? Like, he's singing Bringing in the Sheep. Like, he is a religious zealot, right?
He's like kind of just fucking crazy, right? Like, he's also his nephew died, right? That he somehow finds in this
knees.
Like bizarre fucking weird underground
Which shit, means they brought that
show.
That body 200, 500 miles away, whatever.
It's like, that was like 300 miles. Like,
they're in Dallas.
They hauled that thing. They hauled Franklin, who sucks, and everybody in
fucking
sucks. They hauled him all the way
Franklin.
Across the fucking state to be in this place. And Sally, right? Like, she's, I guess, just still out living the dream. I don't know. I mean, I don't fucking know. But, like, does he even believe in God, or does he believe in anything? Like, just...
I don't know.
He's terrible at chainsaw. If we're going to do a chainsaw discussion, Jesus Christ. I know how to use a chainsaw. I don't want to jump ahead. Are we going to talk about this later?
Well, let me see. Go ahead and say it, and then I'll tell you if we can put a pin in it. So,
the chainsaw scene where he goes and picks out the chainsaw.
No. That's favorite scenes down the way. We'll
I
get
love
there.
That too much.
No,
yeah.
It's not a favorite scene. I guess it's a favorite scene in a way. It's terrible.
All right.
Like, as far as
it's absurd.
Not knowing how to use a chainsaw.
That actually gets me
to
the theme.
That's a good way
of...
to kill yourself using it, or maim yourself using a chainsaw.
It's not about practicality, because everything in this sequel is satire. It's a spoof. It's hyperbolic.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. It's a canon film. I mean, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Really,
it's
yeah.
a canon
definitely.
Film. Like, Leatherface looks like the Toxic Avenger.
He does. Actually,
well,
right.
Well, the
it
difference
may
is...
be the same makeup.
The difference is that Lefty... When we talk about the decline, the Old West and the new way of life, the dying out of the old way of life, Lefty in the sequel is a relic. He's an old school cowboy. He actually has the white cowboy hat. He's the good guy, right?
Yeah.
He thinks this is his divine right to solve this, right? And he comes in, and the other officers on the scene outwardly mock him, right? They call him cowboy pejoratively. And so when he's doing the chainsaw thing, which is insane, right? He'll kill himself, but he literally has the chainsaws, the miniature chainsaws, strapped on his hips like revolvers, right? Like an old cowboy. In his car at the scene of the crime, when he's chatting with the other lieutenant, you'll see in his shotgun side, he's got actual fucking saddlebags draped over his passenger seat. He's an old cowboy. And so
even talks about the moral. He talks about.
He kind of has this Saint Michael thing going on, right? The sword is like it's like he's fighting with the sword against the devil. He's stabbing like, I mean, that's how he kills Leatherface, right? He fucking
stabs him in the belly,
drills him through.
Does he kill Leatherface? That was one of my questions.
Well, is Leatherface, but he does put a chainsaw from the front of his body through the back of his body.
And is like, he immortal? Because he definitely doesn't kill him right then.
No one shows anybody die.
So we move from like Jason Voorhees in Friday the 13th. When does he become immortal? Like when does he become impervious to?
I think the third one is what I would argue, but I would say so. If you're looking at the first movie, right? Again, just comparatively. There's very, very little blood. The second one is crazy gore. The themes are much more overt in two. I mean, consciously, right? Like the symbolism is, like Jesse said, it's much more in your face than one is. One is very skinny. As a film, so yeah. Again, like just comparing the two, right? Like they have similarities, right? Like obviously same director, so there's a lot of the coloring and the lighting is still similar, but like the budget is much more significant, and the special effects are much more significant in the second film. Because of that, I think they, and the fact that they decided to make it consciously more of a comedy, they went hardcore on the gore. It's probably also because it's in the '80s, right? Like, it's just more of what was done.
Decade of decadence, excess. Yeah. It's maximalist. I mean, where the original is minimalist, this is maximalist intentionally. So it wants to go as far away from it.
Some of that is the commentary. As well on like it, the first movie is a 70s movie. It's a very 70s movie. It's very gritty. It's very like
it feels real.
It's hard. Like it's like it goes hard. Let's play it. Like the second movie is, and the second movie is the epitome of an 80s movie. I don't know if it, I mean maybe the epitome and it's an overstatement, but it's very much like there's a lot of ridiculous gore like. As far as like trying, like not ridiculous. I mean, I guess you want like not as a critique, but like as a that's how it is. Like they're doing a lot of gore stuff to where it's very like, I think it's stuff blowing up. There's things happening. Like, and that was one of the things that struck me most about the first one was when I read people talking about like, oh, there's actually very little gore. And I went back and rewatched it. And it's like, there is. It's all insinuations and it's tension. There's very little actual like, like, you even go back and you watch the chicken cut up. She's hanging on a meat hook. Her boyfriend is on the table getting chopped up with a chainsaw. There's almost no actual showing of any of it. You don't see hardly any blood.
A couple things that that came out of the research with this, and it goes, again, back to what you were saying, Michael, where the first one looks so uncomfortable. Right, like the heat and everything. So, one, the actress, when she gets hung on the hook, that expression, this is from an interview, she has, right, is genuine. Because the way they were hanging her was basically like a wire. And it was so uncomfortable that she's like wincing from the pain of being just hung on this wire, right? Another one is that the scene where they bring out the grandfather at towards the end of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the first one, where he sucks on Sally's finger, right?
And they added in sounds, I'm assuming, for that.
They actually cut her finger.
I was going to say that, yeah.
They were like, it was just take after take after take. She was like, just cut my damn finger so he can get this done, right? Like, and so it was just a lot of things like that where, and what's his name? Leatherface, the actor there.
Gunner.
Hurt his leg. Like, when he does the part where it chops down, I was like, he actually burned his leg.
Well, right? they were using a chainsaw with real teeth at various points in the original. And it was like inches away from people during certain scenes. And they were like, like, it's just insane. Like Hooper is insane. And we were going to miss this, so I did want to throw it in there now. But Hooper's concept, at least in part, for the original, he was in like a Woolworths or something. During the holiday season. And he's just like tired of people and wanted out of there. And he thought the quickest way out of here would be to get a chainsaw from the, you know, hardware department and just like mow people down. This is what Toby Hooper was thinking.
He saw like a display for the chainsaws. And he was like, well, what would it be like if I were to kill everyone with a chainsaw?
I mean, he was also definitely influenced because you got to think of the timing. In December of 72, there was the plane crash in the Andes, that soccer team or whatever.
Where they made the movie Alive. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So there's that. There's a lot going on. But I did want to switch gears to catch another theme. And I brought this up. This was going to be my hot take. I already spilled a little bit of it to Joel. But so you watch the first one. And Leatherface has three different masks, right? He's got – shoot, I want to make sure I get the right thing here. He's got his killing mask or his working mask. He's got his pretty woman mask. And then he's got his, what is it called? It's like the maid,
the mother,
like the mother mask, okay, which comes replete with a wig. And he's wearing this either a frock or an apron through most of it. And in the original one, he's got very high pitched voice, like he's affecting a woman's high pitched voice. He does all of the stuff around the kitchen. One of his masks, as he sits down for like the Sunday best, he's got makeup on his mask and lipstick and everything. And then I wanted to pull this up because before I forget it, I screenshotted it. I read from Kim Henkel in one of the iterations of the future ones, according to, well, I'll get there in a second. My hot take is that I think Leatherface or Bubba, as he's, you know, I think he might be either gender fluid or like trans. Henkel writes, the confused sexuality of the Leatherface character is complex and horrifying at the same time. And then there's a film scholar who likens Leatherface's presentation in the film to that of a, quote, tortured drag queen, end quote. And also they talk about, this is, of course, in future ones that were not in the first or the second, but that notes that the film, quote, emasculates Leatherface by fully embracing him as a drag queen who listens to Marlene Dietrich while painting his lips red in a scene that Fassbinder would appreciate. So he has no sex drive in the first one, no interest in any of that, and he tries on all of these different faces, literally and figuratively, and he's different people. What is he? I don't know how to describe who he is.
Let's start off with the second movie. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
The second movie, he wants to fuck bitches, right? Like, that's, like, obvious. That's a main thing.
It's very... blatant.
That's like he's like stabbing.
Identity is different than orientation,
with
right?
With his chainsaw dick. So like maybe he's transgender. I don't know, but he's definitely into chicks. I don't know how that works, but he could be.
No, it's different. Orientation and identity are different. So he could. They are what?
So
trying to wave Joel's his face at him and win him.
Go.
What I would say is one, Ed Gein, which again, loosely based on Ed Gein, Leatherface is, also was or had mixed sexuality, right? Like
I didn't know that.
Which is how you see it present in Psycho with Norman Bates. And with Buffalo Bill, because technically, I misspoke earlier when I was talking about Silence of the Lambs. Ed Gein wasn't, or the character of of Hannibal Lecter wasn't loosely based on Ed Gein. The character of Buffalo Bill was. Mm-hmm. Buffalo Bill is very famously dressed in a woman dress, like an actual dress made of a woman. So I think I'm no psychologist, so I don't know, right? Like, but I would say at a minimum, what you would see is that the absence of the female patriarch has made major ripples in that family. What's that? What did I say?
Matriarch.
Yeah, matriarch. Yeah. Sorry. Has made major ripples. And the fact that it's his, we find out, his sister mother, it's got to mess things up even worse, right? So.
Well, Drayton says to him in the sequel, his older brother Drayton says to Leatherface in the sequel, quote, sex is a swindle, that's all. Don't get mixed up.
Yeah,
I remember. And he also basically gives him an ultimatum, right? Sex or the Saw.
Yeah, the Saw is family.
The Saw is family, right? That trumps your interest or whatever's going on with you. I did also want to say that even though he is into Stretch in the sequel, he does at some point, when she follows him into the underground lair, which we should get into why the fuck there is an entire amusement park underground. But we'll get there in a bit.
I love. I could talk about
I'm
that.
I'm just never going. I don't know how you ever lived in Texas, Slid. I'll never go there.
I assume it's all like this.
Blood crazy, as they say.
Underground caverns that have been made into amusement parks with people hacking people up. That's what I assume.
So Leatherface cuts off Lefty's, or not Lefty, cuts off LG's face, right?
Yep.
And he puts the face on Stretch, and he puts LG's cowboy hat on Stretch. He picks her up, and he starts dancing provocatively with her.
Right.
Why does he dress her up like a man?
I mean, he was a hot broad. I mean,
but why did he dress her up like LG to do that?
He's just a man.
I mean, again, I think it's a confused sexuality is what it comes down to, right? Like, but yeah, it's...
Okay. Well, so the next thing then, we're talking about Stretch.
Do you think these are things they were thinking about when they made it?
Oh, absolutely. The guy had three different masks. One was a wig on it. Yeah.
I don't know that they would have said, oh, he's transgender. I think they would have said,
well, they didn't have that term. That wasn't even in the DSM. That's not in the DSM at that point. So what would they call it? They would call it a drag queen, which is what Henkel calls it.
Exactly.
But the other thing I was going to talk about was, well, I guess, and we talked about this again in the first episode also, it might be recurring. It might be more prevalent in movies than we're aware, but feminism and the role of women leads. And this one, I'll just lead off for it and you guys can tell me what you think. But obviously Sally, sort of by default, she's the scream queen. She's a surviving woman. She's strong enough to make it, right? She jumps out of like 17 windows over and over again.
From the same house.
Right, from the same house, which they must have sugar glass. I don't know what they do in Texas, but they don't make good windows there. But she is pursued the whole time, right? She's retreating the whole time. And in the sequel, Stretch, of course, after she gets assaulted at the radio station in the middle of the night, she fucking survives and then jumps in the Jeep and pursues them to their underground lair.
She
fights them off.
A huge dream state thing going on there. That's the weirdest thing is, like, if you watch when she jumps out of it and when she's doing it, how slow they pursue her and, like, how much it is. It's definitely meant to disturb you. Like, they're walking, like, she's running through the fucking woods. Like, running through the woods in South Texas is pretty shitty. Like, they do a big, like, Leatherface is, like, he doesn't want to just run through it. He uses his chainsaw because it's so painful to even think about running through the fucking woods.
Thorns,
but
right?
He's running through it, right? Yeah, those are mesquite bushes. And so it's like, it's very interesting how they portray all of that when it's going on.
Yeah. Joel, anything on the feminism aspect?
No, I mean, I pretty much agree with what you're saying. Like, it's a much stronger, you know, at least in the way we, as, you know, folks in the, you know, 21st century. Think of strong female leads, right? I mean, that's a lot. I mean, 86 is a long time ago.
But, it's also, yeah, but 86 is also the right around that, like, divorce rates skyrocket.
Yeah.
Women are back in the workplace. They want equality. They want all that stuff. It's sort of that a rebirth of feminism. In what was the modern times for when this movie came out. And so Stretch has her own, you know, she wants to do big things. You know, LG works for her. She runs her own little radio station. No, she says, you know, she says to Lefty, I want to do important things.
She doesn't give the tape over right away. That's right.
She wants to leverage it. She's aspirational. Of course, she ends up killing fucking Chop Top. But let's go ahead. I know we've covered a lot of themes and we could go on forever about this, but I did want to transition us from this. All right. Now I think we can go ahead and talk about our favorite kill. And I absolutely have to lead this off, but I assume we all have the favorite kill if there's any justice in the world. It fucking has to be Franklin. I wish I could have killed him myself. Could you fucking imagine being stuck in a van on a road trip for days at a clip with him in like 115 degree heat, listening to sniveling, whiny nonsense? When Bubba finally catches him in the thicket or bramble or whatever,
you know what? You know what I like about is learning that the actor actually knew that everyone's supposed to hate him, so he intentionally was more annoying.
Yeah,
that's right. They did all trying to drive.
You know what? But I actually think his death is a statement. Like, there's a reason they held him to be the last death.
Yeah.
And
the only chainsaw.
He's the last death, period, right? Like, she never dies.
The Hitcher dies, but the Hitcher.
If you want to count him.
Yeah.
Like, that's the revenge death, right? He's the last death.
Yep.
He's a guy that you should not like. You hate him because of his weakness, right? Like, you hate him like he's the only handicapped, overweight guy of the whole crew.
He's whiny.
There's a statement, you hate him, right?
He's holding everyone back.
Like, they bind it up forever, and then they kill him. So I don't know. Everyone wants to hate Franklin.
Yeah, it's very purposeful.
That's the humanistic standpoint to want to be like, you hate people, Jesse.
I do hate most people.
You don't care about people. You wanted Franklin to die first.
But specifically a guy who says, if I have any more fun today, I don't think I'll be able to take it. And by the way, they get actual, which I just wanted to roll him into the fucking, just a ditch, which he gets rolled into a ditch and he should have stayed there.
He does several times, yeah.
Right,
when he's pissing, right? Like, he gets like the highway.
What's funny? What's really foreshadowing there is in the very beginning, this big 18-wheeler. As Franklin's taking a piss on the side of the road, this big 18-wheeler rolls by. It startles, what's his name? Kirk. Who actually freaks out, and then Franklin rolls down the hill. Of course, it's foreshadowing for the end of the movie where the big 18-wheeler comes down and kills the Hitcher, right?
Right.
But my second favorite kill was from. Well, I just want to get to the two favorites so you guys can do your favorites. Jesus Christ. The other one was in the sequel when Buzz is getting his head sawed in half on the bridge in the opening sequence, which that sequence, by the way, is fucking awesome for me. It's actually stood out to me over all the years, and it's like lodged in my memory. It's probably the goriest kill in either film. Unless you count, I guess, LG getting carved up, but he sort of dies over like 10 scenes. So I don't know. What'd you guys think?
Yeah, those are both great. Michael, you want to go next? Or you want me to?
No, Joel, you
all right. Next. All right, so mine is the first kill, funny enough, because you like the last kill in Texas Chainsaw 1, but my favorite is the first kill, which is Kirk with the hammer and then the door slam. That is so iconic. That and honestly, still freaks me out. It's the most disturbing scene in it because he doesn't say a word. Like, it, and it's they talked about, they used a foam mallet on set, right? So they're really whacking him, right? Because it's foam. And the folio guy, I wrote his name down somewhere, but the folio guy uses, he's taking like a mallet to a mallet. So that's why it sounds like, you know, boom, right, when it hits his head. I love that scene. I think that's amazing. And then somehow his girlfriend does not hear it at all. Has no idea that he's just been drug off. And as he's twitching, which they mimic again with LG in two, you know, he smacks him again and then drags him off. It's great. For Texas Chainsaw 2, it's got to be LG, but I'll be specific. It's when he does his final last gasp, where he's got his face carved off and he's spitting, and somehow, and I don't understand this, but somehow Stretch is just then figuring out it's LG. Like, she realizes, like, she has LG's face on her face, and she has not figured out that and the goddamn cowboy hat on her head. Anyways, so that scene when he finally, when he's got the butcher knife in his hands and he's trying to cut the rope and he's twitching all over the place, and he finally lays down and does his last gasp, that shit's Shakespearean.
Wait a second, what does he say when he dies? Right before he dies, because LG is the hardest motherfucker in the whole film. He says, "Oh shit," and then he dies. By the way, LG, who I loved, was my favorite character in both. But my man is hawking loogies on the floor inside the office of the radio station.
That's why his name is LG. It's loogie.
Get the fuck out! Is it no?
I was just thinking about it. I actually had a note on that. I was thinking about it. His name is LG because it's loogie. Dude, spit! You fucking great, great. Great job reminding me, because I wrote that. I was like, this motherfucker spit, like, spit blue.
I mean, he's got a sinus infection, man. Like, something's... If he didn't die, he needs to go to the doctor.
I didn't think about it.
Yeah,
that's really funny.
So that's my favorite.
All right.
How about you, Michael?
Sled, what do you got?
My favorite death is still... probably when he hangs, it's tied between, it's on the first one, because I love the first one. I still think it's, like, one of the scariest, most amazing, like, it's so intense. It makes your guts screw up when you watch it. And so, like, the two biggest deaths on it are, the second leading lady getting hung up on the hook, and then watching her boyfriend get chopped up.
Yeah.
With a chainsaw, but there's no blood. Like, there's almost no, like, it's just like she's sitting there watching. She's still alive on this hook, watching in the sky getting chopped up, and that's a horrible thing. But then also the scene where they finally bring her up and Sally up into the room, and they're trying to give the grandpa the hammer to smash. Like, it's the most, like... Oh my god! It's like Clockwork Orange, like the drawn outness of just like the intense uncomfortableness of watching. It's just like, holy fucking shit! Can you, like? And it's crazy because it's like, I just wish they would hurry up and kill her. Like, it would make you happier than what you're watching. Like, it's just like and it's all basic makeup and all this stuff, but it works so well. Those are my two favorite deaths. Second favorite movie, favorite death, probably LG again. Like, I mean, the guy, Honky Tonk Man, that's all I always think of him as, Honky Tonk Man. Like, when they peel his face off and they're down, has his savior moment down there in the weird, abysmal, like, hell that they've created.
Labyrinthian hell. Yeah. Well, that's what Lefty says, right? Hell is exactly what they raised. Like, everything for him is literal, like, direct from
biblical,
God. Like,
yeah,
in biblical. Awesome. Awesome kills for everyone. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and throw a curveball here. Our producer, Jay. Sir, did you have a favorite kill? And if so, what was it?
Oh, wow. So, favorite kill... So I'll say the most cinematic kill of any of them was The Franklin, sort of like in silhouette in the Ooh. You know fading light. You know, the trees around and, you know, the chainsaw and his like sort of like flailing arms. It was just like a beautiful just beautifully constructed shot. I thought that was amazing. And for the second one, I love how drawn out LG's death is. And what amazing skulls people in these movies, both of them have, that they can take like these bludgeonings over and over again, where he's just sort of getting like rammed over and over again by John.
Well, LG,
and LG's still like spluttering away. I just love how drawn out that whole thing is. Absolutely delightful.
LG is, I'm sure Sled can attest to this as a Texas guy. I mean, they just make him tough down there. That's really all there is to it. I mean,
except for an axe murderer who actually killed him.
Yeah,
I'm sure he took a bunch of chops before he fucking did away with
LG. You don't know how many
LG.
Hits he took.
He probably took like 70 fucking acts to kill him. All right, let's go ahead and move on. That's just a quick hitter. Let's move on to the next section. Our favorite scene. Okay, so let's think about what scene jumped out at you and stuck with you the most. It could be your favorite. Explain why. I'll go ahead and lead off with this. For me, my favorite scene is either when Lefty goes to purchase the chainsaws at the Cut-Right store. Or when Stretch encounters Chop Top at the radio station. The chainsaw store scene is great because so much is done with so little. It's a really one of those show-don't-tell situations. There's hardly any dialogue. The audience sees how Lefty's a fucking actual madman. You know, he's a true believer. He's guided by God to carry this justice out. His spirit is sublimated in the process. The visual of him with the two little chainsaws fencing like they're knives or swords, and then chopping the hell out of the log while the store owner makes his crazy faces. The Stretch Chop Top scene I like because it's just so uncomfortable. There's like this inevitability to it. You know it's going to end bad, but you don't know how bad. And Mosley, like we talk about, he just chews the scenery up here. He's giving you like the Vietnam vet stuff, the metal plate in his head, the coat hanger that he lights up, scratches and eats, the hippie ensemble, and then Stretch is just desperation trying to hold it together. For me, the whole thing works, and it also propels the plot. It's like a pivotal. It's from like the first scene, the first act to the second act for the Stretch scene, and that's where things really really take off for me.
All right, so for me, it's when Pam falls face first in the house into the feathers. Like the room with all the animal parts. Like, I swear, if you get a chance, watch it again. They change the film quality. It gets grainier. Like, I don't know how they do that. Maybe they slow it down or something. But something happens with, like, the actual... Like, everything is much tighter shots on everyone. It's, like, zoomed in on her face. It's zoomed in on, like... you know, the chicken, it's zoomed in on the lamp, you know, everything. It is so unnerving. And to me, that is the best scene, like the most emblematic of how Hooper shoots Chainsaw One, right? Like that's the scene where I go, yeah, I gotta leave if I'm like I'm just running. I'm not stopping for anyone. Nope, we're just gone. In the second one, personally, it's the scene with Bill Mosley right when they first meet. Right, like when so Stretch and Chop Top meet in the radio station. He is so unnerving. He is so weird and so crazy. And then I'd be like, well, this is now your radio station. I have to go. Right? Like,
dude, she's about her business. That's why she's a strong woman lead.
And I guess I'm not a strong woman lead. I'd have left. Those legs are amazing. What's that?
She has better legs.
She does, much better legs. You don't want to see these things.
She has gams. She has great gams. I don't know.
Great gams.
All right, Sled. What's your favorite scene or scenes?
My favorite scenes, probably in the original one, are. I mean, there's so many good ones. Like it's just the whole vibe. If I want to go for the most uncomfortable is like when he's doing. There's a scene when he's doing the. He's talking about the slaughterhouse, and he's driving by it, and there's a cow just slopping, like just kind of like like, and it's just like, but I mean, what Joel's talking about, like when they're getting in, like the first half of the movie is all just uncomfortable stuff. Like there's, it's even hard to pick a one scene because it's so uncomfortable, all of it. Or when the guy gets in there and he like. Some of the best scenes are all provocative of actual violence. So you're expecting some kind of blood, and like we talked about this earlier, like there's very little actually slaughter in it. But yeah, I guess I would say when they're going into the house and like Leatherface first comes around, he's like, rah! And like fucking acts on them. That's my favorite scene in the first movie. Like it's just like. It's so much provocation towards it and like vibe and feeling of getting to it. Favorite scene in the second one, the worst scene is actually like the first one. Like, holy fuck, like when she finds LD down in the fucking thing and he has like his stomach's hanging out, it's very trauma of like
it really,
like, and it's very, I mean, it's a Cannon Films movie, right? So, like, you, you kind of expect it, but, like, he's there, and he's got his ribs hanging out, and he's, like, hanging her face, like, so ridiculous, but so uncomfortable at the same time. I guess those are my favorite scenes from that one.
You know what that scene, oh, go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what that scene reminds me of, if you've ever seen the movie Nightbreed, remember,
when the guy in the fucking hospital peels his fucking face off. No, I remember that movie 100%. Like, it's very, like, they probably use the same effects. Like, it's very, it's a, just seeing someone get peeled seems fucking off, right? So, that and, I mean, the beginning movie, the beginning scene is so great with the fucking guy. Like, he's so 80s. Like, it's such a time of day. The guy's got the fucking glasses on. And he's like, like, he's like fucking yelling at him and fucking
shooting a big old gun out the window.
I have those guys. I have those guys, Buzz and Rick the Prick, the frat boys who represent the empty privilege and self-indulgence of the times. They're basically middle management, boat salesmen, MAGA. They would be MAGA voters now. They'd definitely be Trump voters now. And that's sort of like what a lot of the sequel is about, is like America selling out. You know, the industrialization of the first one has been completed. Now we're into just this gross excess in capitalism. Drayton sells out, right? Drayton's talking about taxing the fucking, you know, taxing the working man, and complains about the taxes and the property taxes under, like, wherever the fuck he's paying property. And like Joel says, he's trying to pay off Lefty at the end. Lefty's like, you know, has no idea what he's talking about. This is like an extension of that.
It's so great.
Either that or just fucking, what's his name? The guy who's the one in the first one.
Nubbins, the hitchhiker?
I mean, he's by far the most unsettling guy in all the movies.
The hitchhiker, yeah.
Yeah, oh, and not the same actor, but the guy playing him. But, yeah, well, they're the guys who are like, ugh.
All right, those are good favorite scenes. But I do want to segue into our next topic, which is the best line, or lines in this case. Ooh. This is... I mean, both films, particularly the second one, are eminently quotable. So I'll throw the first one out. I think we're probably going to run back and forth on this for a while, but quite obviously the best quote in the whole movie is when Rick the Prick and Buzz are calling into Lefty's radio station, and they're like hammered on Shimer's. They're driving to the OU Texas game, which actually we didn't talk about, but which is a pretty big leitmotif that runs through everything. Hinges on that weekend, and as the one lieutenant says on the crime scene to Lefty, this is people go blood crazy this weekend. This is like insanity, the microcosm of Texas as this insane place, completely preoccupied. Like it's representative of that same meaningless, godless capitalism. Like for
you
them.
Know what it go reminded ahead. Me of, Jeff. What's that? Yeah. That scene specifically where he's talking about like with the whatever, the police officer is trying to act like, oh, no, there's no
right.
family of cannibals, right? Yeah. Like, it's the mayor in Jaws.
It's like, there's no shirt. Yeah.
No, it's not.
No, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
It's the same thing. Right, it's like, oh, no, there's no shark. We can't have a shark on July 4th weekend. You know what it would do to the commerce?
Right.
The shark doesn't care. Right?
Right. So the quote is, of course, Rick the Prick yelling at the phone to Stretch. I don't want to hear it. I want to see it. Bright lights, big titties. Is maybe the best line in the movie. Joel, what do you got?
Well, it's probably one that I will. Pick up. You'll remember the second part, but it's what's his name? It's the cook yelling at the brothers, calling them coon shit over and over again. He does it in the first movie, he does it in the second movie, and that's gross. One, two, it's very memorable. That and something about Dennis Hopper singing, bringing in the sheep through those little cannons or canyons.
Right.
Really sticks with me. I just love it. So.
In the same scene, that's a good one, but in the same scene that we're talking about, Lefty talking with the lieutenant at the crash scene. And he's like, you know, it's just kids going crazy, acting wild for this crazy weekend. And Lefty says to him, one of those boys so wild he saw his own head off going 90 mile an hour.
Yeah.
And like, you know, that like really sets the tone. And the guy vaguely threatens him with like, I have the authority from the DA to shut you down. He's like, you know, basically, fuck you. I'd like to see that authority. But, you know, right. Which leads me to another one of my favorites where he says in response to that, after the guy finally folds and Lefty's going to get him to do what he wants. And he says, Brazos, Brazos. Do you know what that means?
No.
Do you?
Sled, have you ever heard of that? Brazos? Brazos?
Well, the Brazos is the river in Texas.
So that was what I had to look up, the Brazos River. And then I looked at the literal translation. Brazos, of course, means arms in Spanish. So the river was the full title of the river. It was the Arms of God. It was the Brazos River. So I'm like... Lefty is still on that religious shit, and this is about the strength that God is carrying him toward the end of this, the inevitable conclusion of this. I mean, I just thought it was a cool thing to say, and then after rewatching it twice this week, I was like, I gotta fucking look this up. I thought it was a throwaway line, but it might mean more. There's in the beginning of that same crime scene, the lieutenant says to Lefty, as he drives off, he just says it to himself, but it's directed at Lefty. Sort of, you know, derogatory, you know, dismissively. He says, remember the Alamo, cowboy. And then you fast forward to the end of the movie when Lefty has made it down into the lair. And there's that mural of Davy Crockett fighting at the Alamo. And he kicks the wall in, and all the fetid corpses and rotting guts and stuff come out, right? He's at the Alamo. He's refighting the Alamo, which is what the sign says in the opening scene when Buzz and Rick the Prick shoot it.
Like, disgusting part of the movie to me when all that slop fell out of the wall.
Yeah. I mean, that's Tom Savini at his best.
Yeah. I mean, the guy's a master, right? Like,
Lefty also with another quote, I got a perfect willingness to die.
Yeah. So here's something that's interesting to me. Like, there's very little that is quotable in the first one, right? Like, again, it's thin on dialogue, it's thin on plot, and somehow it's very effective.
It's right? As muscular as you can get, right? There's no. Nope. Toby Hooper's not messing around in that one. In this one, it's minimalist versus maximalist.
He's enjoying it.
This to him is fun, having the intentional, willful departure from the original and everything that it meant. Joel, did you have some good quotes you wanted?
No, I mean, you asked me, Jesse. Yeah. I think you meant.
Did you? No, I know you already did some, but did you have any more?
No, I mean, I would say the, no. Which one?
Well, I still have other quotes. And I could go on forever. Chop Top saying, lick my plate, you dog dick.
Oh, lick my plate, you dog
you
dick.
You dog dick. That's one of the best.
Or get that bitch, Leatherface.
That's right. I mean, I already said the sex is a swindle. That's all. Don't get it mixed up. Don't get mixed up in it. Yep. It's Drayton. That's a really good line. I ain't got no fear left, Lord. Lefty talking to his hands for some reason after Stretch leaves him alone in the hotel room. I mean, all of the good quotes come from the second one.
So I'll toss in a couple.
Jay, what do you got?
I had, oh, my aching banana. I like laughed out loud at that
the
one.
Old man at the door. Yeah. That was great.
That was a good one. And just like the epithets from Drayton to his accomplices were just like wonderful. Yeah. You coon shit. You fudgebacker. You'll be the death of me. Coon shit is one he uses over and over again.
Yeah,
yeah.
That like, one I like.
Yeah, Leatherface, you bitch hag, was also another good one. So, yeah, that guy was a fountain of quotes. It's wonderful.
Yeah, he really was. And Drayton, he also says something in the sequel. He does say, so again, it goes back to him as the avatar for like Reaganism, middle management types. Yeah. And he says, it's always the businessman who gets it in the ass, right? And then three scenes later, he gets chainsawed in the ass. Like, and he's under the table and he's like feeling around and he sees that he's got blood on his hands and he's like, cleared up my hemorrhoids. At least he didn't mess me up too bad. And I'm just like, you got chainsawed in the asshole. And he's like, at least he didn't mess me up.
He's got blood all over his hands. It's foul.
There's got to be a lot of good quotes from Chop Top when he's in that scene. I was also like interested in his quotes about Vietnam. Like,
yeah, he kept yelling about napalm and like, you know, you cut my Sonny Bono wig.
But you know what he says? There's another quotable where he basically says that his payout from the VA for the plate in his head is funding the whole operation for the family. Like, Drayton's giving him shit about that. And he's like, dude, this
is
like...
I don't think I caught that.
That's in part great. Two. He says it in the background. But basically, yeah, sure. Like, the whole thing's being funded by his VA checks. So that meal on wheels thing, the Texas chili cook-off stuff, all that stuff is. All right, let's go ahead and tidy this thing up. We'll each give it a rating. Again, I want to reiterate for the listeners out there that the scale of meat cleavers is from 1 to 5. How many meat cleavers do you give each movie? 1, of course, 1 meat cleaver being the worst, 5 meat cleavers being the best. When you give your score, you can do half cleavers if you'd like, and you can discuss briefly why you rated the films like you did. So I'll go ahead and kick this off. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original Tobe Hooper vehicle from 78. I give it 4 meat cleavers. I damn near downgraded it by the time I saw the end of it again, but I had to leave it at 4 because of... you know, just where when it came out and when it did was new, and it's not fair to revisit it so many decades later up against movies that it has spawned, imitators, and the like. So I left it at 4. It's wonderful at what it does. It's haunting. It's disturbing. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, 4.5 meat cleavers. It is clearly better than the original and a cult classic in its own right. It should be remembered more than the original, and I don't care what you say about that, Joel.
Yep. No. And that's what they, you know what they say about opinions.
You some bitch. You dog dick. Lick my plate.
You right, dog dick. You coon shit.
You coon shit.
Yeah, so for me, I would say Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, I would give 4 meat cleavers. It is nearly perfect at what it does, right? Like, it's really, really good for the, you know, mindless slasher, you know, character. And then the family cannibal thing that spawned The Hills Have Eyes and all of those other types of movies. It's just... you know, it kind of set the bar for everyone. For Texas Chainsaw 2, again, it's a personal preference. I'm not big into horror comedies. I am very particular about them. So I gave it a 3 meat cleavers, which means Jesse's going to have it out for me next time we hang out. Mm-hmm. So
yep. I mean, you won't be a guest on the show ever again. That's pretty much it.
That's
Jay,
right. That's
Jay,
right.
Cut him out in editing, please. Sled, what do you got?
So I would give the first one, I guess if you want to do, I mean, there's things that I would improve about the first one, but probably 4.75 to 5 for the first one.
Like, Jesus, I mean, Christ. It's all right.
Damn near the perfect.
Damn near perfect.
Horror. I mean, the, you know, and when I even think about the things that bother me, I think they're things that maybe they were made to put in there. Like, they wanted to make me feel as uncomfortable as possible. And so I think that's some of it. It's almost a predecessor to so many movies. There's so many things in there that are derived in other movies. Like, they, like, saw it and they did it. So, first one is a masterpiece. The first 45 minutes, half a movie is just, like, pure uncomfortableness, and then the last of it, they amp it up to another level to where it's like a different layer of being uncomfortable, to where it's like not direct uncomfortable, it's you're going to watch this chick's eyes be freaked out and listen to her scream. And so, like, they're so, I don't know, at that time, I don't think of any movies that were going to that level of just watching someone do that at that level. And
The cinematography is
amazing, as far as just the vibe and, like, makes you feel gross. The second one is a comedy movie, right? Let's be clear about that. It's a funny movie before it's a horror movie. I mean, there's a lot of gore. It's a canon film, so you know exactly what you're getting when you get into and watching it. There's a lot more of stuff going on. A lot of social commentary. I would give it to be nice to Jesse. I love him like a brother.
Come on.
3 stars out of 5. 3 cleavers out of 5.
God damn. All right, Jess. When you
a
do
lot
this...
of cleaving, but not a lot of scary. The scariest parts of it are the guy in the beginning. The rest of it's all just holy shit. Where are we going from here?
Jay, edit both of them out of this whole show going forward. This is going to be a one-man show, I think, at this point. Well, thank you, guys. Let's go ahead and move to the last section here. All right. Thanks again for joining us for the second episode of Chopping It Up. We had a great time comparing and contrasting the 1974 Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Tobe Hooper's 1986 sequel, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, and we hope you enjoyed it too. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please don't hesitate to let us know. You can shoot us an email at choppingituphorrorpod@gmail.com. Again, that's choppingituphorrorpod@gmail.com. We're up on all major streaming platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Linotes, and YouTube. You can also check us out on Instagram at Chopping It Up Horror Pod. Stay tuned for episode 3 of the show when we review the 1990 film Jacob's Ladder, along with the 2019 vehicle Daniel Isn't Real. Thanks again for listening, folks. We'll see you next time on Chopping It Up.